This is probably the hardest lesson for me in the sense of trying to narrow it down. I was asked to do this first prayer in Habakkuk, and it's really hard for me to just do the first prayer in Habakkuk. I've got three lessons on prayer in Habakkuk, and I'm going to try to fit as much of that as I can into one lesson, is what I've decided to do. The focal point will primarily be the first one, because I think that gives us a really good base of information to build from, and also because that is what I was asked to do. But I'm going to try to fit some other things into it as well, because really this entire book is about Habakkuk's struggle with God, about what's going on in the world around him, and beyond that, what God's answer to him was when he appealed to God. That didn't set well with him either. And we got the beginning of that in the reading, and I appreciate people being willing to do the length of readings that I'm giving. But chapter 2 is God's second response to Habakkuk, and chapter 3 is Habakkuk's final prayer in response to God. The entire book is this back and forth, and we don't have the time to read the whole thing or talk about the whole thing, but I would encourage you to do so. When you have time, there's so much to gain from this little book. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that Habakkuk is willing to go to God and say, God, why is it like this? Because that's what he does. That's what we heard in the first of Habakkuk's appeals to God, is God, why is it like this, and how long is it going to be like this, and when are you going to do something about it? And God's answer is, well, I am going to do something about it. And then Habakkuk says, oh, I don't like that either. And it is the simple reality that you see in Habakkuk is that the sinful, broken world is an ugly place. And what I would suggest is that we don't do ourselves any favors by pretending like it's not. And that is how we need to approach God as we think about these sorts of issues. It is unhelpful for us to pretend like the world is what it isn't. At best, it's unhelpful. It can go all the way to downright dishonest. And I would suggest here at the outset that God fully understands that the world is broken. We're not, you know, opening his eyes to anything he's not aware of. And what he has done is he has given us example after example after example of people who go to God and say, God, the world is broken. You see it, as we mentioned already this morning, in Lamentations. You see it in the Psalter that is filled with lament. You see it in the book of Habakkuk. There are more laments than any other kind of psalm when you talk about that. You see God's faithful people struggling with God and with life constantly in the Bible. And it's hard to imagine that God has inspired so much of this lament language in order for us to say, oh, that's nice, I think I'll never do that at any point in my relationship with God. That doesn't really fit the way we look at anything else. And so Habakkuk becomes just such an excellent example for this. And that's going to be a large part of our focus as we look at this. Habakkuk is one of the prophets that doesn't have a date. Different prophets give us their timeline exactly. And Habakkuk is one that doesn't have a date. But we can kind of narrow it down a little bit based on God's answer to Habakkuk, which is basically, the Babylonians are going to come destroy you all real soon. That kind of narrows it down. Now, you might have noticed in the reading, or if you're looking at the text, that it typically will say they're Chaldeans instead of Babylonians, and that can be a confusing thing. So just briefly on that, the Neo-Babylonian Empire that was led by King Nebuchadnezzar and, you know, his father before that, but Nebuchadnezzar's the real one who takes over the world, it was ethnically Chaldean. And so that's why you will get the back and forth language between Babylonian and Chaldean. They were rooted in Babylon. It was a Babylonian empire that was ethnically Chaldean. And so that language goes back and forth that way, just to explain that. But the point is, they're coming soon. And so very clearly, this is near the end of the period of the divided kingdom. The northern kingdom has almost certainly fallen at this point, and the southern kingdom will fall soon. What that means is that Hezekiah's reforms were very short-lived. Josiah's reforms after that were very short-lived. None of their children really followed in their path. Jeremiah's preaching, if it's that late, has fallen on deaf ears. And there is wickedness reigning in Jerusalem throughout the nation. The government is wicked, but beyond that, Jeremiah shows us that the entire religious structure is wicked as well. The priests in Jeremiah 2 are not spiritually astute enough to recognize evil. The false prophets preach their own opinions, giving the people what they want to hear. And from Habakkuk's position, what's worse about all of it is that God is just sitting idly by and letting it happen. Let me read again verses 2 through 4. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, and you will not hear, or cry to you, violence, and you do not save? Why do you make me see iniquity? Why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. It's a very short appeal to God that Habakkuk has here. It's a very short prayer, and there are two basic ideas, and it's the ideas of violence and justice. Those are the words that get repeated. Those are clearly emphatic points here in this prayer. And so I want to take a second and think about what Habakkuk says about those. But first, the word violence itself is a word that conjures in our minds images of causing physical harm. And you say, well, yeah, that's because that's what the word means. Of course, that's what it conjures in our mind. Well, it does mean that, but it means something bigger than that. At least the Hebrew word that gets translated violence does. We don't necessarily have an exact English corresponding word to that, which is part of the problem. But you can understand what that word might mean when you pick up the connection linguistically in the English words violence and violate. And we understand that not everything that is a violation of something or someone is necessarily physical violence of some kind. And that gives you an idea of what this Hebrew word is getting at. Any sort of violation of standards, any sort of violation of relationship would be covered by this word. So yes, physical violence could very well be part of it, but violation of family relationships, violation of laws, violation of anything could fall under this. And so whether it's community standards or whatever else the case may be, this is a pretty broad sort of word. And it's violations of covenant and relationship that should not be the sort of thing that goes unchecked, right? Those violations, someone needs to put an end to those sorts of things. In fact, God's law speaks explicitly about abuses of law. And the ideas of violence and justice, justice is supposed to solve violence. And yet that's not what's happening. These two ideas are not appearing in the relationship that they should. The way that it should work is someone violates the law and justice solves the problem. And what is happening instead is everyone's violating the law and no justice is happening at all. And that's Habakkuk's basic problem here. The presence of violence should lead to justice, and that's not what is happening. But what's worst about all of it is that it seems to Habakkuk that God is the one who's behind the whole thing. Why do you make me see iniquity? Why do you idly look at wrong? You know, one of the things that I talk about when I'm teaching Old Testament poetry and we're talking about lament is that the psalmists say things in their prayers that make us uncomfortable. They say things in their prayers that we wouldn't dare say in our prayers. And I wonder who's or ours. What's the real issue here? Are they wrong for the things that they say in an inspired book of the Bible? Or are we wrong for not feeling comfortable enough with God to be honest? And this is what Habakkuk feels at this moment. God is making him see this. God is idly looking at wrong because God does not hear and God does not save, he says right at the outset of his prayer. On top of that, God's law is powerless to stop it. God's law has been hamstrung so that the law is paralyzed. Justice never goes forth. And those few times that it actually does go forth, it goes forth perverted, he says. And so he calls upon the Lord to do something about this. When he says, how long, like I said this morning, that's a question of lament. But it's not just a, how long is my indication that I'm lamenting, and so here's my literary clue or something like that. I think he's legitimately asking, God, how long is this going to last? Why is this happening? God, you're idly sitting by as your standards and your purposes and your laws are thwarted and you're not doing anything about it. When is this going to change? Destruction and violence and strife and contention, sin upon sin upon sin are all going down and nothing is changing. Another way of describing it is to say that what Habakkuk is wrestling with is a tension between his understanding of God's character and his experience of God's absence. Habakkuk knows who God is. He knows what God's about. He is just and he is righteous. And he is not doing anything about the injustice and the unrighteousness. And so although Habakkuk never actually asks for God to do something specific, even as he says how long and he asks why, he is asking God to do something. When are you going to do something? Please do something, is the essence of this prayer. God, keep your covenant, maybe another way of saying it. The problem is that Habakkuk has no idea what that's going to look like. Because God's answer to Habakkuk is, well, yes, I will, in fact, keep my covenant. That's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to keep my covenant. You might remember, Habakkuk, that I told my people long ago, back in the book of Leviticus and in the book of Deuteronomy, that if they break the covenant, they will be punished to bring them back. And if they continue to break the covenant, they will be punished to bring them back. And if eventually it gets to the point that I have to, I will drive them out of this land and they will be taken captive to another place. Well, Habakkuk, the time has come. I am going to keep my covenant. I'm not absent from the scene. I'm not ignorant of what is happening down here in Jerusalem. I have a plan to solve the problem that you are worried about. And that plan is the Babylonians are coming. A group of people that captures nations in verse 6. They inflict violence on their path in verse 9. They take prisoners of war in the same verse. They overrun every fortified city in verse 10. They gather captives like sand. Now, isn't that something to say there? The Babylonians gather captives like sand. That's what you'll be gathered up like. You hear the echo and the undoing. Your descendants, Abraham, will be like the sand on the seashore. The Babylonians are gathering the sand now and turning this nation over for punishment because they have broken the covenant. And for Habakkuk, God's answer is really no answer at all. I just got done complaining about violence in verses 2 and 3, Habakkuk might say, if he had the copy of the book of Habakkuk with verses in it. I just got done complaining about violence, and your reply is the Babylonians are coming with more violence? Well, that's not going to solve anything. I just got done complaining that justice never goes out, or when it does go out, it's perverted. And you tell me the Babylonians are coming with justice that is of their own making? I ask you why you idly look at wrong. And what do? You tell me to look and see the justice you're going to bring. So many of the words from Habakkuk's complaint, God uses those words in his answer, but not in the way that Habakkuk would expect the answer to be given. In fact, you might say from Habakkuk's perspective, at every single point, God's answer does not make the situation better, it makes the situation worse. Habakkuk may be thinking something like, wow, God, the cure is worse than the disease. This doesn't help me understand much of anything at this point. There's no clarification for my confusion. There's no comfort for my distress. I still don't understand what you're doing and why you're doing it. He goes on to say in his second prayer in verse 12, are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them as a judgment, and you, O rock, have established them for reproof. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong. Why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? You make mankind like the fish of the sea, like the crawling things that have no ruler. He brings all of them up with a hook. He drags them out with his net. He gathers them in his dragnet so that he rejoices and is glad. Therefore he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet. For by them he lives in luxury and his food is rich. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever? And he goes on to say that he will stand and wait and watch for God's reply. The second prayer divides into two basic parts. Verses 12 and 13 are truths about God's character, and verses 14 through 17 are truths about God's actions. And in Habakkuk's view, I think the point is these two things seem to be in contradiction with each other. Notice, though, what Habakkuk understands about God. First, he is the Lord God in verse 12. And again, Lord there in all capital letters is the name of God in the Hebrew text. And it is God, the covenant God of Israel, which is what that name signifies. He understands who God is. There's a relationship between God and Israel that Habakkuk acknowledges here. He also understands God's character here. Verse 13, you who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong. God is holy, God is judge, God is pure. All of which is simply to say that God is indeed God. But again, these truths about God only complicate the matter from Habakkuk's perspective. Because I still don't understand why you're doing what you're doing, is what Habakkuk is saying. And in this prayer, what Habakkuk essentially says is, well, I understand that you have to do something about this, God, but they're worse than we are. How can you sit back and watch the person destroy the one who is more righteous than he? Yeah, we got problems over here in Jerusalem. I know that. I kind of brought it up. I get it. It's my fault, right? But Babylon is far worse than we are. I don't understand this judgment. I wanted judgment. I don't understand this judgment. And so the question shifts from verse 3, why God idly lets violence prosper in Jerusalem, to now in verse 13, how he could idly let the Babylonians destroy his own people. And they are indeed worse, aren't they? They're violent people. They're destructive people. After they accomplish all the things they accomplish, they offer sacrifices to their nets. The worship of the creature rather than the creator. Because it's not really the net. It's the one who wields the net. It's their own strength that they trust in here. And so how can God use these people to punish his own? How can God let this happen? When is God going to do something different? And so Habakkuk again says, I'll wait and we'll see. And this is when we need to greatly summarize things because we just can't talk about all of chapters 2 and 3. But chapter 2 is God's answer to Habakkuk's second prayer. And the answer is, in essence, don't worry, Habakkuk, they are not going to escape my judgment. But that doesn't get you guys off the hook right now. They will be judged in due time as well. The bulk of chapter 2 is a series of five statements of woe on the Babylonians. for their extortion and theft in verses 6 through 9, for their 6 through 8, their unjust and illegal gain in verses 9 and 10, their violence in verses 12 through 14, their drunkenness and related shameful behavior in verses 15 through 17, and their idolatry in verses 18 through 19. There are plenty of reasons to judge the Babylonians, and they will be judged. On two occasions in chapter 2, these woes are interrupted to emphasize truths about God that stand in contrast with the surrounding language about the Babylonians. In verse 14, talking about the Babylonians being shamed and humiliated, it stops and says, but, the knowledge of the glory of God will be spread throughout the earth. And then down in verse 20, after talking about the lifeless, powerless idols that the Babylonians have built, and they speak to that can't do anything at all, he says, but the Lord is in his holy temple, and all should remain silent before him. And so there is the destruction and the judgment that will come to the Babylonians, and there are these two truths about God and who he is. And that leads then to Habakkuk 3, which is his final response to God. And I wish we had the time to talk about Habakkuk 3 because it's pretty marvelous in its own right. But Habakkuk 3 basically divides into two parts. There is three parts. Verse 2, which is Habakkuk saying, okay, God, this is it. We'll do what you want. O Lord, I have heard the report of you and your work. O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. And the larger section of the prayer, verses 3 through 15, is Habakkuk's vision of God coming in judgment and victory as a warrior, which we won't take the time to read. And then finally, verses 16 through 19, is Habakkuk's fear and faith at the prospects of what the future holds. I hear and my body trembles, my lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones, and my legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon the people who invade us. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. And again, there's so much that we just don't have the time to unpack here in this prayer. But notice Habakkuk's acceptance. And even in the acceptance, the plea. In wrath, remember mercy. God, I understand that you are going to do what you have to do, but be true to who you are. Remember mercy even in the midst of wrath. Well, that was an incredibly fast snapshot of the book of Habakkuk. And there are so many more things that we could say about the text itself and the prayers themselves, but hopefully you can get an idea of the back and forth between God and Habakkuk, the inner turmoil that Habakkuk is feeling as he wrestles through these issues of his day. And it opens the door for us to think about prayer in perhaps a different way than we typically think about it. One of the points of emphasis that I make as I study biblical prayer, and I made it this morning as well, is that biblical prayer is so frequently rooted in God's covenant, in God's character, God's word, God's promises, all those things that are really part and parcel of the same thing. I think that's true here as well. Maybe in a surprising way, maybe in a different way, especially since it's a lament, it might be kind of surprising. But I think it's important to notice that lament in the Bible is not just complaining for the sake of complaining. Lament in the Bible is taking a deeply distressing concern to God for him to act in response to it. And the reason why people lament in the Bible is because they have reason to believe that God will do something about it. And that reason is based on the fact that he is their God. He is the covenant God of the nation of Israel. And that's why they are going to him in their lament. So even as they complain to God about their circumstances, it is a complaint that is rooted in his character. And it is rooted in his covenant. That they believe that he will hear and act because of who he is. And lament can be difficult sometimes for Christians who are unfamiliar with it. But let me suggest to you, lament speaks more about faith than never lamenting. There are presumptions, there are givens that are rooted in biblically based kinds of lament. If you lament, it means you believe that God exists. Because there is no point in lamenting to the ceiling. Maybe you blow off some steam or something, but no good will come of it. If you lament, you believe God exists. But more than that, if you lament, you believe that God hears and he cares. Because there's no point in lamenting to a God who doesn't care about his people. A God who is off in some distant corner of the universe doing something distant and different because he doesn't care about us that much. A deistic God, to use that terminology. No point in lamenting to that God. You believe that he is there. You believe that he hears and he cares. And it also means you believe that he can and he will act. Because again, sure he hears, sure he cares, but he's probably not going to do anything about it. Why lament to a God like that? Biblical lament, taking a deeply distressing concern to God for his responsive action, only happens if you are a person of faith. But also it says something about your relationship with God, if you are willing to lament. Let me ask you a question. I ask this question when I talk about lament all the time. And it's the sort of question that as soon as I ask it, you're going to say, wow, that's a really stupid question. The answer's so obvious. But that's part of why I ask it. Who's a closer friend for you? Is it the sort of person that you must put on a brave face for them as you hide your true feelings? Or is it the sort of person that you are willing to let them see you at your worst? The reason it's a stupid question is because the answer is obvious, right? The one you put on a brave face for, the one you won't show your true feelings to, the one you have to play a game of I'm not who I really am, that's really not a friend as far as that goes. We're not even talking about who's the closest friend. That person isn't much of a friend. Your closest friends are the ones that you go to about anything and everything, however bad it is, however ugly it is, however awful it is. Those are the people that you have a deep and abiding relationship with. What does it say about our relationship with God if we won't be honest with Him about the ugliness of the world in our lives? I think it's probably a misguided attempt at reverence. But the Bible gives us example after example after example of people being open and honest with God with language that makes us uncomfortable. Maybe think about it this way. You're having a particularly bad spell in your life. Things are going terribly in every imaginable way. It's bad at work, it's bad in the family, bad in traffic, bad with your neighbor, bad with your health. Everything's going badly. And you wake up in the morning and what you think is, my goodness, I hate life right now. Everything is awful. And after you think that for a few seconds, it cycles around until what you say is, my goodness, I hate life right now. Everything is awful. And a few seconds later, what you think is, my goodness, I hate life right now. Everything is awful. And that is kind of your running mantra through the day. And maybe sometimes you stop and you detail how awful it is and why it's awful and all of the things that are going wrong and how terrible it is. And it's nonstop all day long what is filling your mind. And somewhere along the line, you think, oh, look at that. It's time to pray. Dear God, thank you for being such a wonderful God who blesses us in so many ways and gives us all the beauty of this world and has so deeply filled our lives with this and that and the other, and you know, it goes on and on for a while, and you say, in Jesus' name, amen. My goodness, I hate life right now. Everything is awful. And again, maybe it's an attempt at reverence. I've got a different word for it. When my son comes to me and tells me something that I know is in direct opposition with reality, I call it a lie. That's what I call it. It's not like God hasn't heard us the rest of the day. It's not like God didn't know what we were thinking all day long and how we've been feeling for days or weeks or months or however. It's not like he is unaware of those things. So why, in the very moment that God has given us for us to cast our cares on him, do we suddenly feel the urge to pretend like we don't have any cares? That language even creeps into the church sometimes. I meant to listen closely to remember, and I don't remember, and so I hope I'm not stepping on any toes from either this morning or this evening. But I know you've heard, because I know I've heard in just about every congregation I've ever visited, help us set aside the cares of the world as we come to worship you. And I don't quibble with the terminology. I don't have any objection to the idea. I mean, if what I'm saying is I really want to focus on God and so, you know, help me not think about my empty stomach or something stupid like that, then sure, whatever. But if what we're talking about is we have real problems in our life and what we need to do is set them down at the door as we come into the building so we can worship in an undistracted way, all that's going to happen is we're just going to pick them right back up when we leave. God has given us prayer to cast our burdens upon him, and God has given us each other to help bear those burdens. The last thing that we need to be doing when we come into the assembly of God's people is to set aside the cares of the world, unless we're setting them aside at his throne in our prayer or setting them on the backs of our brethren who he has given us. Lament is completely legitimate. And here's part of why. You know who the first person in the Bible to ask why is? Well, it's not that exact word, but the question is there. When in Genesis chapter 3, God says, "What is this that you have done to Adam and Eve?" And he says in chapter 4 to Cain, "What is this that you have done?" And then shortly after the Exodus, he says to his people, "How long?" And we saw twice in Numbers 14 this morning, "How long?" And how many times does Jesus say, "How long must I be with you?" Even the saints in perfection are depicted as longing for the righteous retribution that will fall on the wicked in Revelation 6 as they say, "How long?" You see, the problem with lament and our perspective on lament is that sometimes we think it means that we're fighting against God. We take complaint to God as meaning we're disrespecting God. But what we need to understand is that when God looks at the sinful and broken creation, what God says is why and how long. And when we look at the sinful and broken creation, we are not standing against God when we ask those questions. We are standing beside Him. We are asking the same questions that He asks. It really means we have a closer to divine point of view than a human point of you. That's what lament is. It's not mere complaint. It's not adolescent whining. It's not moaning about the hardships of life or anything like that. It is going to God in trust and giving Him our burdens because that's what He has given us to do. The person who trusts completely in God is the one who can tell God anything. The one who has to put on a fake happy face is the one that doesn't have much of a relationship with God in the first place. Let me say one last thing about this that I think is really important as well. And it has to do with how we present ourselves. Actually, let me read you a quote. I don't know how everyone feels about quotes. That's another thing I don't know from congregation to congregation. I like it when someone says something really well. And I like to share that. And I understand that human words aren't the words of God, but I really like how this author says this. This is from Donald Galvin's book. It's called The Triumph of Faith in Habakkuk. He says, Christian worship tends to be all triumph, all good news. And what does that say to those who at the moment know nothing of triumph? That they've muffed it somehow? That their faith hasn't been strong enough to grant them success? That the whole business is a fraud? Has the Christian gospel completely eliminated the need, which Israel so recognized so clearly, to lay all the failures of this life very openly before God Himself and ask Him as a believing, worshiping community, why and how long? Pain and oppression and injustice are still with us, and it's not enough just to say to the one suffering the present hurt of all that, Christ is the answer. We need to cry with them first and plead with God a good bit. Smile, God loves you, is too little to offer, but most of our corporate worship, I fear, does not move beyond that level. You know, there's a problem that we have in the assembly sometimes, when we pretend that life isn't ugly out there in the world. And that is, we tell to those people that are experiencing it, sorry, we don't have a whole lot to offer you. You really should just be doing better all on your own. That's not why we are here. That's not what this is about. And don't we do that individually as well sometimes? I've gone to church with a lot of turmoil, with personal struggles, with besetting sins, and I've acted like my life was all put together perfectly. And what does that communicate to the person who is struggling and looking for help? That they've dropped the ball. That they should have their act together. It's one of the tragedies of this life that the church is not the example of fellowship and support and openness and honesty that Alcoholics Anonymous is. Why is it that we fail at what a group of drunks succeed in? You go in, you admit the worst of your failings, you're greeted by people that have the same failings, and you commit yourselves to each other to help stay on the path. That should be the description of God's people. Instead, we're a group of people that meet together, and we act like everything's okay. And we get patted on the back by someone else who's acting like everything's okay. And we go our separate ways without any problems ever having been addressed. And I don't mean to say that every service, everybody needs to open up about all of the worst of their failings. But we need to have people in our circle that support us and know. And we need to be those people for others who are struggling with those things. if someone who is struggling with this life, whether it's temptation or suffering or whatever it is, if someone who is struggling with this life comes into an assembly of God's people and they walk away more discouraged than when they came, we have failed as God's people. There must be honesty and openness and reality when it comes to the ugliness of this life. And that doesn't mean you do it once. Habakkuk says, how long and why? And God says, well, here's my answer. And Habakkuk says, how long and why? And God doesn't greet him with some lecture about vain repetitions or anything like that. As long as the repetition isn't vain, it's not a problem. In fact, the darkest psalm in the entire book is Psalm 88, and we don't have time today to unpack that. But it is a lament that has no ray of hope at all. Most of the laments, there's a little bit of hope somewhere. Psalm 88, there is no hope at all. He is one who calls out to God day and night. He calls upon God every day, and his call is unheard, and he will call upon him again the next morning. For this man, there is no understanding, there is no answer, there is no happy ending. He just keeps pleading. Psalm 88 is the story of a man who refuses to give up on God and a God who is willing to constantly hear him. And what an example that is for the people who need that example in their lives. Suffering is an ugly, awful thing. Sin is an ugly, awful thing. And it does us no good at all to pretend like it's not there. Honesty with God is the path forward. A very long time ago, when my father was growing up as a child, he lived in the northwest corner of Arkansas, in a time of great poverty, and his family was very poor, in fact. To celebrate special occasions in their household, my grandfather would take the family to the corner store and buy them all a grape knee-high. If you don't know what that is, think glass bottle Fanta. That was a celebration. It was a bottle of soda. Well, my father kept the bottle caps from those trips in a box. And as kids do, he carried his treasured possession everywhere with him, wherever it was, no matter what, it went with him. One day he was walking through the house and he tripped and the box went flying and it landed in the register that let the heat up from the furnace and down all the bottle caps went. And they just got stuck down in the vent area. They didn't go down and burn or anything like that. But my grandfather wasn't too keen on taking the effort to get them out. It's just a bunch of bottle caps. But my father was absolutely inconsolable about this loss. He cried and he cried and he cried and he cried and he cried until finally my grandfather decided to take the whole thing apart and get those bottle caps back for him. Now, if you're a sentimental sort of person, you might understand a little bit of his sorrow. If you're less sentimental, you probably think that's silly, they're bottle caps, get over it. But whatever the case may be, what's really interesting about that story is two different things. First, my dad thinks it's kind of silly at this point in his life. And he has for a very long time. Because again, however sentimental you are, they're bottle caps. You can get over that. Even if they are bottle caps from a special occasion, they're bottle caps. You can get over that. It's not that big of a deal. He gets that now. And the second thing that's amazing about it is he doesn't remember that happening. You all have that story in your life, right? You know the story backward and forward, verbatim, exactly how your parents told it a million times, but you don't remember it because you were too small. You know the story, you don't know the event. That's what this story is for him. Something that now he thinks is silly, and something that he doesn't remember at all. Something that was once so traumatic has changed so drastically with his perspective today. as we look at the suffering in this life, and the sin and the evil in this life, I think of this story very often. Because I think sometimes we have a wrong impression of what the Bible promises when it comes to this issue. I'm sure that somewhere between most and all of you have sung the words, "Farther along we'll know all about it, farther along we'll understand why." And that's a nice thought. I don't know that the Bible ever promises it, though. I don't know that the Bible ever says, one day God will explain everything to you in such a way that you can fully appreciate His wisdom in the matter. There are two verses I think about when I think about this. The first is in Job, when Job makes his great declaration of faith, "I know that my Redeemer lives." And as he goes on to talk about it, what he says is not, "On that great day, then I will understand, and in understanding everything will be made right." No, he says, "I will see God." And in Job's mind, that was enough. When Paul says, "The present sufferings are not worth being compared to," the end of the sentence is not the explanation that God will give us. It kind of sounds dumb when you say it that way, doesn't it? The present sufferings are not worth comparing to the glory that will be revealed. The biblical perspective is not that we will be given the answers. The biblical perspective is that the glory of heaven will make us not care anymore about the sufferings of this life. As nice as it is to think that maybe one day we'll understand, you know what's better than that? What's better than that is to realize that the worst things that we ever experienced on this world is nothing but a collection of bottle caps that we wonder how we ever got so upset by it. The glory of being with God will change everything. And until we get there, God says, "It's okay. Come to me and tell me how bad it is. I'm here to listen. And my people are here to help." That's what God has given us. That's what God's people, this group of God's people, all groups of God's people are supposed to be. And so, as I said this morning, it raises a question for us to consider. Are we being that group of people? If we're not, and we should be, if we're not because we've never joined and we want to be a part of a group of people that are like that, there is another opportunity tonight. A continual opportunity that is always available, but right now, in a special way, we stand ready to help you. To help you come to Jesus for the first time, to help you make something right in your life. If there's some way that we can help you, let that be known as together we stand and sing.